This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now for the changing state of hate in America. The Southern Poverty Law Center publishes an annual survey of the nation's hate groups. Among the headlines this year, the number of active hate groups is at a 10-year low. But that does not signal a decline in white supremacist, anti-immigrant, and anti-government patriot activity. It's just been driven underground. The study found a surge in hateful activity online. Mark Potok is senior fellow at the SPLC. Mark, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
First, a little on which criteria your study uses to designate a hate group.
Well, what we define as a hate group has nothing to do with criminality or violence or any kind of estimate we're making for the potential for those things. It's strictly about ideology. Does a group say that an entire group of people, by virtue of their class characteristics, is somehow less? In other words, if a group says all white people are blue-eyed devils, all black people are criminals, all the Jews are whatever it may be, those kinds of statements. So that's what we're looking at.
And your reporting since the year 2000, show a big upward trend in hate groups. Can you give us a snapshot of the last decade or so?
Sure. Well, hate groups kind of rose and fell in the 90s, and then they rose very steadily from about 1999 on, peaked in 2011, didn't change much in 2012, and has begun to fall by about, I think it was about 10-12% between 2012 and 2013, and 20% between 2013 and 2014. You know, we think what's happening is that people are leaving organized groups but staying essentially within the kind of milieu of the movement. They are increasingly moving onto the internet. It's not like they haven't been there in large numbers before, but what we're seeing is fewer and fewer people wanting to be associated with the groups for a number of reasons. I think a big part of that is that the cost of being exposed as a member or associated with these kinds of groups has essentially gotten higher and higher every year. And that, I think, is driving people into the kind of anonymity of the internet where they're very active.
Okay, so doesn't mean they've disbanded, but changed form or forums, I guess, online. What are some of those popular forums?
Well, Stormfront is probably the very best known one. Stormfront is a very large web forum run by a former Alabama Klan leader named Don Black. That forum has something very close to 300,000 registered users, so it's enormous. In addition, we are seeing large numbers of people move into password-protected forums, in particular on a network called VK, which is a huge Russian social network. So people are at the same time being chased off, by people I mean people in the white supremacist world are being chased off forums like Facebook and increasingly going to these somewhat more obscure places. In addition, we see communities forming, for instance, within the Reddit world, a lot of subreddits that are intensely racist, in fact, much more racist than what you will find normally on a forum like Stormfront.
Stormfront calls itself, by the way, the voice of the new embattled white minority. So you see where they're coming from. So noticing all of this activity online, it's just people venting on the internet. Is it just talk?
Well, one of the things that we found in this study we did this year was that, in fact, violence in terms of real domestic terrorism or attempted domestic terrorism has not diminished at all. And in fact, it's comparable to the very high levels we saw in the mid to late 90s when the militia movement was kind of at its initial peak. So, we did a quite careful calculation and found that the killing rates really are essentially the same if you don't take into account the Oklahoma City bombing, which, of course, left 168 people dead. So it skews the numbers rather wildly. So, it does not seem that the movement is diminishing. It seems that it's changing form. In the same way that we see people going off into, onto their own in the Internet, we also see those people with real criminal intentions increasingly acting as lone wolves. In other words, carrying out whatever kind of attack it is they do carry out on their own.
So not necessarily meeting or plotting together, but carrying out their own activities. I'm wondering how this underground activity changes the strategy of the FBI or law enforcement or organizations like the SPLC tracking hate groups, in your case, taking legal action against them.
Well, it makes it incredibly difficult. And let me say, this is a very long-running trend. This is not something that just happened in the last year. Really, the extreme right, and to some extent as well, domestic jihadists have been going in this direction for many, many years. In the case of the radical right, some 30 years. And this has to do with the really the ease with which law enforcement has been able to bust open conspiracies when they involve a fairly large number of people. These people don't seem to be able to keep their mouths shut. And so very often these plots have been stopped. But there's been really a theoretician, a guy named Louis Beam, a well-known Klan leader or former Klan leader, who has been pushing for a long time this idea of act on your own. Don't organize into pyramidically structured organizations. Because if you do, law enforcement, by finding one person, can break apart an entire organization. So, to answer your question, lone wolves, or people who operate in pairs, are incredibly difficult to stop because it is so unusual for somehow a leak to develop, for news of that to get out before the actual attack takes place. We can't simply attach a police officer or an FBI agent to every person who has unpleasant or even violent views. And so it's a very, very hard thing.
We're speaking with Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which released its annual report on hate groups in the U.S. Well, the good news is the number of active hate groups is at a 10-year low. That doesn't mean that hate groups in the U.S. are on the wane. It just means they've been driven underground, and a lot more activity is happening online. What about groups like Reddit? Are those being tracked and watched carefully by law enforcement?
I doubt it. I mean, they don't consult certainly with us about who they're tracking exactly. But, I know that law enforcement agencies keep a fairly close eye on Stormfront, where very many well-known neo-Nazis and Klansmen and so on tend to congregate. But Reddit, of course, is a group of essentially normal people, people who aren't associated with these kinds of groups by and large. And yet, what's happening is that we're seeing some of the subreddits develop into really quite amazingly hateful places. There is one sort of series of subreddits, a community known as the Chimpire. And you can imagine what that's about. It's a whole series of Reddits or subreddits attacking black people. There is another one called Philosophy of Rape that is really quite astounding. It's written by a guy who claims to have personally raped 7 women, and he is urging other people to do this as a way of, quote-unquote, correcting women, for their alleged, sluttiness and all that kind of thing. I mean, it really is quite amazing. So there are people openly pushing criminal activity in some of these places with really appalling language.
So, Mark, you and your colleagues at the Southern Poverty Law Center, when you're looking over this new landscape of hate, is it more concerning to you to have active, big groups, vocal, vocal, easy to see, swelling numbers, or this online activity going on with smaller cells?
Well, in a lot of ways, the situation we're in now is more worrying. It may seem counterintuitive, but I think the fact is that many of the larger groups, in effect, have had the effect on their members of holding them back. They are, in effect, kind of saying, yes, boys, we'll kill the Jews, but that'll be next week. Because at the end of the day, the leaders of these groups are not interested in going to prison for the rest of their lives, but they are interested in kind of whipping up the troops and being the leader and so on. So we've seen that time and again. The people who really do tend to attack are people who drift away from the groups, who despise them as the meat, eat, and retreat crowd, as they will say. And those really are the lone wolves out there who are almost impossible to predict. I mean, it's just not possible to know what day a certain person will wake up and decide that today is the day to start killing.
Mm. So, Mark Potok, thank you for your time.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Potok, Senior Fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And you can look at more on the SPLC's annual report on hate groups on its Hate Watch blog. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from 21st century online hate groups to accusations of intolerance at the heart of one of America's cheeriest institutions. Comedy shows like The Family Guy and Saturday Night Live have portrayed Walt Disney as a paranoid anti-Semite. Up next, historians consider the evidence to find out whether Disney's legacy is indeed tarnished by anti-Semitism. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
When Walt Disney died in 1966, he left a vast legacy, including theme parks, an animation studio, numerous feature-length and short films, and the California Institute of the Arts. Historians have focused on some more disquieting aspects of his life. There have been allegations that he may have been an FBI informant, was interested in cryogenics, and was known to make anti-Semitic remarks, all of which Disney defenders denounce as slander. Producer Eric Malinsky wanted to know if the accusations of anti-Semitism were true, and why there's still a point of fixation nearly a century after Disney's death.
A couple of years ago, Zac Efron and Daryl Hammond sent up Walt Disney on a Saturday Night Live sketch.
But I thought you were frozen.
I recently thawed out. Science says global warming, but I can't help thinking it has something to do with Jews.
This caricature of Disney as a paranoid anti-Semite has been showing up a lot in recent years in shows like Robot Chicken or Family Guy.
Brian, we could spend the rest of our lives here. It's perfect.
Sounds good to me. Doesn't seem to be a thing wrong with this place.
Hello, everybody.
Jews!
Oh, yeah, I forgot. This is a Disney universe.
But what evidence is there that Walt hated Jews? He didn't write anti-Semitic manifestos like Henry Ford. He gave to Jewish charities. He even got an award from B'nai B'rith in 1955. Tom Cito is an animation historian and a former Disney animator. He traces the rumors back to 1941. Disney artists had just gone on strike, a very divisive strike, to create a new labor union.
Some of these artists, they're in their late 80s, and they're still angry at one another, based on what they did in that summer of 1941.
Disney's cult of personality was very strong within the company. Friendships were destroyed based on who sided with him or against him. And Disney took the strike very personally. He tried to ruin the careers of many of the union organizers. But when Tom Cito was writing a book about the conflict, he noticed something.
A number of the strike leaders were of Jewish ancestry.
Artists like Arthur Babbitt, who's credited with creating Goofy. And many of those Jewish strike leaders were the same animators that later told biographers that Walt was anti-Semitic. There were Jewish employees that stayed loyal to Walt. In fact, some of them worked with Tom Cito at Disney, and they told him that Walt had no problem with them being Jewish.
People like Marty Sklar, who was the senior designer of Disneyland. For Disney to risk, basically, one of his biggest gambles was going into the theme park business, and it very easily could have, like, ruined his studio. So the fact that he entrusted the design of the first Disneyland to somebody like that, you know, says a lot.
It's sort of like that old cliche, you know, some of my best friends are Jewish, so I must like Jews.
The writer John Powers has also researched Disney.
It's not rumor to point out, for instance, that in 1938, when the Nazi filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl came to Hollywood, the leaders of the studios boycotted her.
Disney gave her a tour of the studio.
Now, you could say, well, maybe he liked her films. But if you look a little more closely, actually, he couldn't have liked her films. The only films that were available were Triumph of the Will, a ridiculous Nazi propaganda piece. Olympia was not available at the time.
Tom Sito sees a more innocent explanation. Riefenstahl had come to Hollywood with a copy of Olympia, her banned film about the Olympics. And apparently, she later told an historian,
Riefenstahl thinks the reason why Disney wanted to meet with her was because one of the few film festivals he lost was the Venice Film Festival of 1938. He was beaten by Olympia. And it kind of bugged him that he wanted to see this movie that dared beat Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which was sweeping everything at that time.
There's another example that people cite in making the case against Disney, The Three Little Pigs. At one point during this 1933 animated short, the big bad wolf dresses up as a Jewish peddler.
Who's there?
I'm the Fuller Brush Man. I'm working my way through college.
The American Jewish Congress was not amused. They lobbied Disney to remove the sequence. He made some minor changes years later, but he never understood why they found it so objectionable. Even the Looney Tunes were making ethnic jokes back then.
Now we kind of look at these things as crude stereotypes. But I don't know if they were thought that way at the time.
So the evidence of Disney's anti-Semitism could be written off as gossip, ignorance on his part, or guilt by association. But John Powers is convinced there is something there. And he's particularly interested in a trip that Disney took to Germany in 1935. As part of his research, Powers visited the Disney studio in Burbank, and he asked the librarian,
do you have anything about Disney's visit to Munich? This really happened. The guy looked at me and said, no, we don't. We don't have anything. And so I said, well, okay, thank you. And as I'm leaving, he looks at me and says, well, wait a minute, we do have something. So he went and he produced these microfilms of Nazi newspapers like the Völkischer Beobachter welcoming Disney as a hero against the Jews of Hollywood.
Now, that just may be Nazi propaganda. There's no record that Disney met Hitler, though he did go out of his way to meet the other European heads of state, including Mussolini. This discovery fired up Powers' imagination. He wrote a play called Disney in Deutschland that ran in San Francisco that explores what would have happened if Disney met the Führer.
The set of the play is designed like the room in the Berghof that Hitler used when he would have visitors there, which had a model of the ideal Germania. Anyway, Disney comes in. He starts playing with the model until, as you can imagine, by the end, it looks more and more like Disneyland.
At first, Hitler is annoyed that Disney is playing with his toys. But eventually, he admires Disney's vision of a utopian world.
The theme of my play is that there is a thin line between fantasy and fascism. I think that fantasy and fascism can be related when responsibility and a sense of social justice are not involved.
This may be a more fruitful line of inquiry, because regardless of whether the man himself was anti-Semitic, his movies and his theme parks had a huge cultural impact.
Essentially, it is a celebration of aristocratic power.
Professor Jack Zipes studies fairy tales. He thinks the Disney view of the world is strangely medieval. Take Snow White, for instance.
The final scene shows the prince carrying Snow White off on a white horse into a distant castle. So the images always suggest there is a male aristocratic power that is charming, that is handsome, that is good, and should be celebrated.
Zipe says this authoritarian message also plays out in the tightly controlled, ultra-conformist universe of Disney theme parks.
Most of these parks are really intended not to animate your mind, but really to exploit you for the time that you spend there.
The last few Disney princess films haven't done so well at the box office, so maybe his conservative vision is losing appeal. Or maybe it's just relocated to the street. A lot of cities are using Disneyfication as a model to gentrify real places like Times Square, Las Vegas, or downtown Burbank. And that in turn might explain why so many cartoons like Shrek and Family Guy continue to lampoon Disney, bringing back these old rumors and accusations. The artists are basically declaring their independence from a world that is becoming more and more Disneyfied.
Disney ratted out animators for being communists?
Sure, they were union rousers. They had to go.
I heard he was anti-Semitic.
Semitic.
And that story was produced by Eric Malinsky for Tablet Magazine's podcast.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
Nowadays, sharing information is just a click away. In early New England, delivering news and letters was a dangerous and arduous process. Up next, an historian reveals an astounding method used by the first settlers, Native American couriers. That story coming up after the news.
Is in your dream. No request is too extreme.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. American news junkies don't have to wait long for a fix. Political squabbles, eruptions of violence, celebrity foibles, and rumors come at us as if sprayed from a fire hose. It's hard to imagine colonial settlers waiting days or even weeks to learn that a loved one had passed. In the early days of New England, distributing and receiving information was critical, not only to those in power, but to citizens desperate for news and supplies. And getting a letter from one town to another was often a dangerous undertaking. Catherine Grandjean is assistant professor of history at Wellesley College. She discovered a surprising method used by America's first settlers, Indian couriers. She's author of American Passage, The Communications Frontier and Early New England. And Catherine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So give us a sense of New England in the early 17th century. What did it look like?
You know, New England was a very different place. It was, frankly, I think, much more precarious and tenuous and unfamiliar than the sort of quiet, orderly Puritan towns of popular imagination. In fact, when I started the research for this book, one of the things I realized very quickly was that New England was not a sort of contiguous block of territory. It was really, in fact, a kind of smattering of English islands, settlements very far-flung and distant from one another, and really just a kind of archipelago of English settlement in a really vast sea of unfamiliar Native American territory. Mm-hmm. So it's not the place that we necessarily think of when we think of colonial New England.
Yeah, there's this picture in your book of like tiny enclaves surrounded by this vast, mysterious forest. So how did colonists travel between these settlements with no visual maps?
The short answer to that question is quite often they didn't travel between these settlements. The territory was so unfamiliar and sort of daunting and in some cases dangerous that they stuck to the water, generally speaking. And so one of the primary modes of travel in the early days of colonization would have been the canoe. That is one of the reasons certainly why you find them when they have to send news, especially if it's emergency news, hiring Indian couriers, because Native people are the ones who understand the geography.
Tell us more about this idea of Indian couriers. I mean, I think of back then the news would have been of Indian raids or conflicts, yet
right.
Indians
right.
carried them.
Well, that's what intrigued me. You know, I was sort of just combing through 17th century letters, and I kept stumbling across Native people carrying letters for the English. And that seemed provocative and surprising to me because, as you said, this is a period in which relationships with Native people are not always friendly. Sometimes there's war, sometimes there's tension. And so the idea of handing over a kind of precious letter, a precious piece of news to a Native person seems like a kind of problematic thing to do, or at least some kind of admission of vulnerability. But in fact, they did. And so that's a kind of interesting thing to say about early New England, which, after all, was a place where everyone agreed you should be able to read and write, and communicating with letters was incredibly important. So the fact that that all rested on Indians is, I think, interesting.
Really interesting. And you say you discovered this from looking at the letters. Were there references to Indian couriers in the letters?
Yes. In fact, 17th century letters often will say who was going to carry the letter or who had carried a previous letter. And so truly, letter writers will mention, I received your letter by Nepomcent, or mention other native couriers by name. So you can kind of see them traveling the landscape when you start to put the letters together. And the story that sort of sucked me in, frankly, was this one particular letter from 1649, which told of the death of John Winthrop, the great founder of Massachusetts Bay Colony, who famously said that they were founding a shining city on a hill in Boston, a kind of model for all the world. And when he died in 1649, his son lived really quite far away to the south, about 100 miles away in what is now Connecticut. And so the men who were attending Winthrop as he was failing and dying had to find a way to send the news to his son in order to summon him in time for the funeral and let him know that his father had passed. And the only way that they could do that in that moment, apparently, was to hire a native man named Nahaton. And Nahaton lived a little outside of Boston. He was well known to the English. He was friendly to the English. He had experimented a little bit with Christianity, so he was a sort of safe person to go with. But I thought it was very telling that in that moment, these really powerful Englishmen who we all think of as sort of running the show in early New England would turn to a native person to send this incredibly important and time-sensitive piece of news.
Right. I can see why they would need to get the news out there, but what would be the incentive for a Nahaton or any other Indian courier?
You know, it's a good question. And often the incentive was purely economic. So these messengers would be hired, and they would be paid very often in trade goods, wampum, which sort of shell beads that functioned as a kind of currency in early New England, or cloth, some other type of item that Indians would want. But often, too, I think they looked to sort of gain advantage by befriending Englishmen. This is a period in which it was not totally clear just how formidable the English would be or become. And so many native groups kind of hedged their bets by cultivating relationships with colonists. And I think that's part of the equation, too.
Well, obviously, the news of Governor Winthrop's death is big news. But you examine thousands of these letters and write that New England was built on letters. So what were they writing about in general? And who was writing?
You know, everyone wrote. I shouldn't say everyone, frankly, but because New Englanders were Protestants, the sort of very committed Protestants we know as Puritans, they believed everyone should be literate and be able to read the Bible, and in many cases, people could write. So people from sort of all levels of society certainly wrote letters. Even the barely literate wrote letters. And they wrote about everything. They wrote about family news. They wrote about threats of war. They wrote very poignantly about illness and sought advice for various kinds of ailments when their wives were sick, when their children were sick. They wrote in search of trade goods. They wrote to get things like fruit from neighbors. They wrote for all kinds of reasons, all the reasons probably we would find familiar. So you do get a sense of the society when you start to read their correspondence.
Catherine Grandjean, her new book is called American Passage, and it's about how the disparate little towns of the early colonial American nation communicated with each other, part of which was through Indian couriers. How reliable and organized was this system of using Indian couriers?
You know, I think not organized at all. And this was really a kind of improvised solution to the problem of trying to communicate across unfamiliar distances in the colonial world. And so it's not systematic in any way. It's in no way a kind of early coastal system. This was just kind of individual colonists seeking out native people to carry their letters when they had some piece of urgent news to send. And in terms of how reliable, that's hard to say. Sometimes Indians kind of lingered on the trail and they took a long time and they didn't necessarily go as directly as our colonists would have hoped. So it was unpredictable, I think, but in many cases the only option.
Well, besides the economic incentive for these Indian couriers, was there any other sort of political purpose that may have been served in their, in a sense, controlling communication?
There are political advantages to be won, I think. When Indians were that intimately involved in English networks of news, they could, of course, gather information for themselves. Not so much by reading letters, because for much of this period, Native people could not read English, and that's one of the reasons why they made appealing couriers. But certainly, being that plugged into colonial communication meant that Native people could either plant spurious rumors or kind of leverage their position of power in this world of talk and news and letters by kind of manipulating the news that traveled through those channels. Mm-hmm. And it's an important pattern to see happening in early New England, I think, and understand that even when English colonists look like they're in a position of power, they are often kind of thrown off their pedestal by these kind of ripples of fear and terror that strike every so often period.
It's a propaganda campaign in some way.
It is. And, you know, I would say English leaders spent much of the first century of New England's history kind of tracking down whispers of Indian threats and conspiracies and plots and potential attacks, and sometimes really on the basis of no more than a wisp of information or a really kind of marginal rumor that came from some remote place. But they really were sort of forced to put energy into that for much of the century, and that's an important pattern.
Mm-hmm. Well, as unreliable as it was, this was a primary means of communication in the early colonial settlements until the post office was established in 1704. What role did these Indian couriers serve in the formation of the colonies that they may have even opposed?
Communication is so essential, and I think at the end of the day, you can't really understand how the English established themselves in the New World, in the Northeast, without seeing how they established connections between colonies. And so part of that, of course, is by hiring Indians to send letters, and part of it is building roads, and part of it is launching newspapers and establishing a postal service. But yes, as the colonial period moves forward, you start to see that communication is critical to how the colonies were settled.
Catherine Grandjean, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Catherine Grandjean, Assistant Professor of History at Wellesley College and author of the book American Passage, The Communications Frontier in Early New England. You'll find a link for more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Why would film studios spend millions on movies and TV shows that they hope no one will ever see? Stay with us as we dive into the curious practice of ashcan copies, producing movies and TV shows solely to retain intellectual property rights. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, the FXX cable channel aired a short half-hour adaptation of Robert Jordan's hugely popular fantasy series, The Wheel of Time.
You and I have fought battles for 1,000 years upon the turning of the wheel, 1,000 times 1,000, and we will fight again until time dies and the shadow is victorious.
this so-called pilot starring Billy Zane is an unmistakably low-budget production. It debuted at 1:30 in the morning and was never advertised. It's as if the studio responsible for the pilot, Red Eagle Entertainment, didn't want anybody to see it. Which, as it happens, is exactly the case. The Wheel of Time pilot is what we call an ashcan copy, a movie or TV show made solely for the purpose of retaining intellectual property rights. Clay Wirestone is a columnist at the Concord Monitor and a contributor to Mental Floss, where he recently wrote about the history of the ashcan copy. And Clay, another obscure thing you bring to us. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what would happen if Red Eagle Entertainment did not play this 30-minute pilot for the Wheel of Time series?
Well, some of that may be legally in dispute, but in general, what would happen, you know, most intellectual property kind of contracts or whatever come with a kind of a sell-by date. You know, you have to have something shown on TV or in a theater by a certain date, or else the rights to make a film or make a TV show go back to the original copyright owner. So in this case, it would go back to Robert Jordan's estate.
So they have to not just make it, but actually play it.
Yes. And, you know, generally that's kind of one of the interesting points about the ashcan copy in terms of something that's filmed or on TV. There generally has to be some way for some number of people to see it. Now, not necessarily the biggest audience of all time, but just some audience, which in this case is, you know, basically a late night infomercial time slot.
Why is it called an ashcan copy? I mean, it sounds obvious. Right.
It actually dates back to the golden age of comic books, the 1930s, 1940s, when the titles of comic books were a little different than they are today. Comic books were not actually about a specific character. They were oftentimes anthologies of stories about various characters. So they'd be called something like Flash Comics or Action Comics, or the original comic that starred Batman was Detective Comics. And similarly, you had very kind of oddly generic superhero names like Captain Thunder or Captain Marvel or something like that. And likewise, publishers just wanted to prove that they were the first one to come up with this name for a character, first one to come up with this title for a comic book. So what they would do is they would take, you know, actually maybe pages from an old comic book or just pages from a waste paper basket and just slap a new cover on it with the title, maybe print, you know, 3-4 copies. One needed to go to the Library of Congress for the purposes of establishing copyright. Mm-hmm. The other maybe would go into their files, and maybe one for sale on the street, but just enough to establish their copyright claim to those names. You know, and basically, for want of any other better term, we now can use it to talk about some other kind of adaptations in other media.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other notable ashcan copy films that people might be surprised to hear about?
Well, I think the kind of the most notorious is an adaptation of the Fantastic Four that was made in 1994. Back in the 80s, Stan Lee had actually negotiated the film rights for the Fantastic Four to a German company called Constantin Film, a producer named Bernd Eichinger. He later went on to produce the film Downfall, which has the little film clip of Hitler that's so often subtitled with various other things online. But Eichinger tried for nearly 10 years to get an adaptation of the Fantastic Four up and running for film. It never really worked out, and the contract was in danger of expiring, and he still wanted to make a movie. But to just fulfill the letter of the contract, to be able to keep going, he enlisted Roger Corman, kind of a notorious low-budget director and producer of films, to make a $1.5 million adaptation of the Fantastic Four, which even in 1994 was basically no money to make a movie. Although everyone who was actually working on it believed that it would actually be produced, it would actually be shown in theaters. Uh-huh. They actually hired the full slate of people you'd have to make a movie, a composer. You know, everything was in place. They made the movie. And by most accounts, it's pretty awful. And Marvel just bought the movie from Constantin Film and basically put it in a vault.
Well, actually, it's on YouTube in its entirety mm-hmm. now. Let's listen to just a clip from it. This is the 1994, let's call it the unreleased ashcan copy of the Fantastic Four.
Hey, you guys, Colossus is closing awfully fast. I mean, this thing's really motoring.
We don't have a lot of time, Susan.
I'm all set.
Engage. The second it hits the inner circle, Johnny, you activate the gravitational field.
Aye, aye, sir.
Ben, no matter what, you keep her steady.
That's exactly why you pay me the big bucks.
That could have been made, you know, in my basement when I was a kid with felt costumes. Now, for $1.5 million, how much would you compare that to the Fantastic Four franchise now?
Well, you know, it's funny because what happened was is that Constantin Film, because they made that, retained the rights. And finally, in 2005, so about 11 years later, they brought another actual big screen adaptation of the Fantastic Four to theaters. That version of it cost about $100 million to make. And it actually was pretty profitable. I think it, it actually made them money. They made another sequel in 07, which also made some money. But neither of those films were particularly critically well received. And especially now that Marvel films are even more popular than ever, they're going to try rebooting it now, I think, for a third time with a new version that's coming out this year. Although, interestingly enough, Constantin Film still has the rights, is still one of the producers mm-hmm. of the reboot that's coming out.
Well, this Ashcan tradition goes back, as you said, to the 1930s and 40s, but in the 60s, there was an Ashcan copy of The Hobbit made. Now, tell us a little bit about this movie, if we can call it a movie.
Well, exactly. So basically, a producer named Bill Snyder had snagged the rights to The Hobbit for a song. A big studio passed on making a big budget adaptation of the film, but Snyder knew that if he just held on to it for a little bit longer, he'd be able to sell the rights back to the Tolkien estate or sell them to someone else for a bunch of money. So in order to get something in theaters, in a theater rather, before the magic date hit, he called up an animation director named Gene Deitch and said, "Listen, I just need something. 12 minutes, any length." The contract didn't specify that it had to be a full-length movie, and it didn't specify that it had to be a fully animated movie either. So Gene Deitch just basically put together a 12-minute reel of The Hobbit, still pictures, a narrator, some background music, and it was enough. They screened it in a single theater in New York City, had people pay a dime to come in and see it. And that was The Hobbit. It was enough to keep the rights with Bill Snyder, and he was able to sell them off again for a hefty profit.
Let's hear a clip from this 1966 version, if you can call it that, of The Hobbit.
"So it has come to pass," said the great wizard, "that Dale has been destroyed by Slag, and that he nests on the treasure in the carved halls under Lonely Mountain, just as it is written in the great book. Then it is clear that the time has come. The time of the Hobbit. Far away from all the troubles of dragons and treasure lived a certain hobbit. Like all hobbits, he lived in a hole in the ground."
Well, certainly in the case of The Hobbit, the rights to an established franchise can be worth huge sums of money. So for fans of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time franchise, what does Red Eagle Entertainment gain from pursuing a much bigger adaptation of the same material?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's one of those situations where, almost kind of like The Hobbit, the ground was shifting underneath the feet of Red Eagle Entertainment on this. I believe they obtained the rights in the 1990s. The series was best-selling at that time, so they knew it was of some value. But since that point, over the last 20 years, you know, fantasy has just become a bigger and bigger part of the entertainment landscape, and particularly now with the George R.R. Martin
Game of Thrones series
on HBO. I mean, it's potentially incredibly lucrative for Red Eagle and for Robert Jordan's heirs. And of course, this is why this, you know, 30-minute late night almost infomercial version of the series was such a point of interest and actually a point of contention, because Robert Jordan's widow, you know, kind of took to Facebook after it was broadcast, said she had no idea that this was going on, you know, said that as far as she was concerned, you know, the rights were coming back to them and they were going to, you know, go on their own way. And then Red Eagle Entertainment apparently has started a lawsuit against her for defamation over this. So it becomes a very contentious situation.
Clay Wirestone, columnist for the Concord Monitor and a contributor to Mental Floss, where we found his article, "The Weird History of the Ashcan Copy." Great speaking with you.
Oh, great to be here.
And there's a link to read the article for yourself and see some clips from these astronomically bad movies at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety at the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.